industry. Bizarre shenanigans like the Watergate burglary were given full treatment, while instances of ongoing practice, the My Lai massacre, the secret bombing of Cambodia, the work of the FBI and CIA, were given the most fleeting attention. Dirty tricks against the Socialist Workers' Party, the Black Panthers, other radical groups, had to be searched for in a few newspapers. The whole nation heard the details of the quick break-in at the Watergate apartment. There was never a similar television hearing on the long-term break-in in Vietnam. In the trial of John Mitchell and Maurice Stans for obstruction of justice in impeding a Securities and Exchange Commission investigation of Robert Vesco, a contributor to Nixon, George Bradford Cook, former general counsel of the SEC, testified that on November 13, 1972, he crouched in a Texas rice field while on a goose hunt with Maurice Stans and told him he wanted to be chairman of the SEC. For this, he would cut out a critical paragraph in the SEC charges against Vesco that referred to Vesco's $200,000 secret contribution to the Nixon campaign. Corporate influence on the White House is a permanent fact of the American system. Most of it is wise enough to stay within the law. Under Nixon, they took chances. An executive in the meatpacking industry said during the Watergate events that he had been approached by a Nixon campaign official and told that while a $25,000 contribution would be appreciated, for $50,000, you get to talk to the president. Many of these corporations gave money to both sides, so that whichever won, they would have friends in the administration. Chrysler Corporation urged its executives to support the party and candidate of their choice, and then collected the checks from them and delivered the checks to Republican or Democratic campaign committees. International Telephone and Telegraph was an old hand at giving money on both sides. In 1960, it had made illegal contributions to Bobby Baker, who worked with Democratic senators, including Lyndon Johnson. A senior vice president of ITT was quoted by one of his assistants as saying, "The board of directors have it set up to butter both sides, so we'll be in a good position whoever wins." And in 1970, an ITT director, John McCone, who also had been head of the CIA, told Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State, and Richard Helms, CIA director, that ITT was willing to give $1 million to help the U.S. government in its plans to overthrow the Allende government in Chile. In 1971, ITT planned to take over the $1.5 billion Hartford Fire Insurance Company, the largest merger in corporate history. The Antitrust Division of the Justice Department moved to prosecute ITT for violating the antitrust laws. However, the prosecution did not take place, and ITT was allowed to merge with Hartford. It was all settled out of court in a secret arrangement in which ITT agreed to donate $400,000 to the Republican Party. It seemed that Richard Kleindienst, Deputy Attorney General, had six meetings with an ITT director named Felix Rohatyn, and then brought in the head of the Antitrust Division, Richard McLaren, who was persuaded by Rohatyn that to stop the merger would cause a hardship for ITT stockholders. McLaren agreed. He was later appointed a federal judge. One of the items not mentioned in the impeachment charges and never televised in the Senate hearings was the way the government cooperated with the milk industry. In early 1971, the Secretary of Agriculture announced the government would not increase its price supports for milk, the regular subsidy to the big milk producers. Then the Associated Milk Producers began giving money to the Nixon campaign, met in the White House with Nixon and Secretary of Agriculture, gave more money, and the Secretary announced that new analysis made it necessary to raise milk price supports from $4.66 to $4.93 a hundredweight. More contributions were made, until the total exceeded $400,000. The price increases added $500 million to the profits of dairy farmers, mostly big corporations, at the expense of consumers. Whether Nixon or Ford or any Republican or Democrat was president, the system would work pretty much the same way. A Senate subcommittee investigating multinational corporations revealed a document, given passing mention in a few newspapers, in which oil company economists discussed holding back production of oil to keep prices up. Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Corporation, 75% of whose stock was held by American oil companies and 25% by Saudi Arabia, had made $1 profit on a barrel of oil in 1973. In 1974, it was making $4.50. None of this would be affected by who was president. Even in the most diligent of investigations in the Watergate affair, that of Archibald Cox, a special prosecutor later fired by Nixon, the corporations got off easy. American Airlines, which admitted making illegal contributions to the Nixon campaign, was fined $5,000. Goodyear was fined $5,000. 3M Corporation was fined $3,000. A Goodyear official was fined $1,000. A 3M official was fined $500. The New York Times, on October 20, 1973, reported, Mr. Cox charged them only with the misdemeanor of making illegal contributions. The misdemeanor under the law involved non-willful contributions. The felony count involving willful contributions is punishable by a fine of $10,000 and/or a 2-year jail term. The misdemeanor by a $1,000 fine and/or a 1-year jail term. Asked at the courthouse here how the two executives who had admitted making the payments could be charged with making non-willing contributions, Mr. McBride, Cox's staff, replied, That's a legal question which frankly baffles me as well. With Gerald Ford in office, the long continuity in American policy was maintained. He continued Nixon's policy of aid to the Saigon regime, apparently still hoping that the two government would remain stable. The head of a congressional committee, John Calkins, visiting South Vietnam just around the time of Nixon's fall from office, reported, The South Vietnamese army shows every sign of being an effective and spirited security force. Oil exploration will begin very soon. Tourism can be encouraged by continued security of scenic and historic areas and by the erection of a new Hyatt Hotel. South Vietnam needs foreign investment to finance these and other developments. She has a large labor pool of talented, industrious people whose cost of labor is far less than Hong Kong, Singapore, or even Korea or Taiwan. I also feel there is much profit to be made there. The combination of serving both God and Mammon had proved attractive to Americans and others in the past. Vietnam can be the next takeoff capitalist showplace in Asia. In the spring of 1975, everything that radical critics of American policy in Vietnam had been saying, that without American troops, the Saigon government's lack of popular support would be revealed, came true. An offensive by North Vietnamese troops left in the South by terms of the 1973 truce swept through town after town. Ford continued to be optimistic. He was the last of a long line of government officials and journalists who promised victory. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, February 19, 1963, victory is in sight. General William Westmoreland, November 15, 1967. I have never been more encouraged in my 4 years in Vietnam. Columnist Joseph Alsop, November 1, 1972. Hanoi has accepted near total defeat. On April 16, 1975, Ford said, I am absolutely convinced if Congress made available $722 million in military assistance by the time I asked, or sometime shortly thereafter, the South Vietnamese could stabilize the military situation in Vietnam today. 2 weeks later, April 29, 1975, the North Vietnamese moved into Saigon and the war was over. Most of the establishment had already, despite Ford and a few stalwarts, given up on Vietnam. What they worried about was the readiness of the American public now to support other military actions overseas. There were trouble signs in the months before the defeat in Vietnam. In early 1975, Senator John C. Culver of Iowa was unhappy that Americans would not fight for Korea. He said that Vietnam had taken a mighty toll on the national will of the American people. Shortly before that, Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger, speaking to the Georgetown Center for Strategic and International Studies, was reported as being generally gloomy, saying that the world no longer regarded American military power as awesome. In March 1975, a Catholic organization making a survey of American attitudes on abortion learned other things. To the statement, "The people running this country, government, political, church, and civic leaders, don't tell us the truth," more than 83% agreed. New York Times international correspondent C.L. Sulzberger, a consistent supporter of government Cold War foreign policy, wrote in a troubled mood in early 1975 from Ankara, Turkey, that the glow has worn off from the era of the Truman Doctrine, when military aid was given to Greece and Turkey. He added, "And one cannot say that the bleak outlook here is balanced by any brilliant United States successes in Greece, where a vast mob recently battered the United States Embassy." He concluded, "There must be something seriously wrong with the way we present ourselves these days." The problem, according to Sulzberger, was not the United States behavior, but the way this behavior was presented to the world. It was a few months after these reports, in April of 1975, that Secretary of State Kissinger, invited to be commencement speaker at the University of Michigan, was faced with petitions protesting the invitation because of Kissinger's role in the Vietnam War. Also, a counter-commencement program was planned. He withdrew. It was a low time for the administration. Vietnam was lost, the very word supposed it was ours to lose. Kissinger was quoted that April by Washington Post columnist Tom Braden. "The U.S. must carry out some act somewhere in the world which shows its determination to continue to be a world power." The following month came the Mayaguez affair. The Mayaguez was an American cargo ship sailing from South Vietnam to Thailand in mid-May 1975, just 3 weeks after the victory of the revolutionary forces in Vietnam. When it came close to an island in Cambodia, where a revolutionary regime had just taken power, the ship was stopped by the Cambodians, taken to a port and a nearby island, and the crew removed to the mainland. The crew later described their treatment as courteous. "A man who spoke English greeted us with a handshake and welcomed us to Cambodia." The press reported, "Captain Miller and his men all say they were never abused by their captors. There were even accounts of kind treatment, of Cambodian soldiers feeding them first and eating what the Americans left, of the soldiers giving the seamen the mattresses off their beds." But the Cambodians did ask the crew about spying and the CIA. President Ford sent a message to the Cambodian government to release the ship and crew, and when 36 hours had elapsed and there was no response, the message had been given to the Chinese liaison mission in Washington, but was returned the next day, ostensibly undelivered, one press account said. He began military operations. U.S. planes bombed Cambodian ships. They strafed the very boat that was taking the American sailors to the mainland. The men had been detained on a Monday morning. On Wednesday evening, the Cambodians released them, putting them on a fishing boat headed for the American fleet. That afternoon, knowing the seamen had been taken off Tang Island, Ford nevertheless ordered a marine assault on Tang Island. That assault began about 7:15 Wednesday evening, but an hour earlier the crewmen were already headed back to the American fleet. About 7 o'clock p.m., the release had been announced on the radio in Bangkok. Indeed, the boat carrying the returned crewmen was spotted by a U.S. reconnaissance plane that signaled them. Not mentioned in any press account at the time or in any government statement was a fact that emerged in October 1976, when the General Accounting Office made a report on the Mayaguez affair. The U.S. had received a message from a Chinese diplomat saying China was using its influence with Cambodia on the ship and expected it to be released soon. This message was received 14 hours before the marine assault began. No American soldier was hurt by the Cambodians. The Marines invading Tang Island, however, met unexpectedly tough resistance, and of 200 invaders, one-third were soon dead or wounded. This exceeded the casualty rate in the World War II invasion of Iwo Jima. 5 of 11 helicopters in the invasion force were blown up or disabled. Also, 23 Americans were killed in a helicopter crash over Thailand on their way to participate in the action, a fact the government tried to keep secret. Altogether, 41 Americans were killed in the military actions ordered by Ford. There were 39 sailors on the Mayaguez. Why the rush to bomb, strafe, attack? Why, even after the ship and crew were recovered, did Ford order American planes to bomb the Cambodian mainland with untold Cambodian casualties? What could justify such a combination of moral blindness and military bungling? The answer to this came soon. It was necessary to show the world that giant America, defeated by tiny Vietnam, was still powerful and resolute. The New York Times reported on May 16, 1975. Administration officials, including Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger, were said to have been eager to find some dramatic means of underscoring President Ford's stated intention to maintain our leadership on a worldwide basis. The occasion came with the capture of the vessel. Administration officials made it clear that they welcomed the opportunity. Another press dispatch from Washington in the midst of the Mayaguez event said, "High-ranking sources familiar with military strategy and planning said privately that the seizure of the vessel might provide the test of American determination in Southeast Asia that, they asserted, the U.S. had been seeking since the collapse of Allied governments in South Vietnam and Cambodia." Columnist James Reston wrote, "In fact, the administration almost seems grateful for the opportunity to demonstrate that the president can act quickly. Officials here have been bridling over a host of silly taunts about the American paper tiger and hope the Marines have answered the charge." It was not surprising that Secretary of Defense Schlesinger called it a very successful operation done for purposes that were necessary for the well-being of this society. But why would the prestigious Times columnist James Reston, a strong critic of Nixon and Watergate, call the Mayaguez operation melodramatic and successful? And why would the New York Times, which had criticized the Vietnam War, talk about the admirable efficiency of the operation? What seemed to be happening was that the establishment, Republicans, Democrats, newspapers, television, was closing ranks behind Ford and Kissinger, and behind the idea that American authority must be asserted everywhere in the world. Congress at this time behaved much as it had done in the early years of the Vietnam War, like a flock of sheep. Back in 1973, in a mood of fatigue and disgust with the Vietnam War, Congress had passed a War Powers Act that required the president, before taking military action, to consult with Congress. In the Mayaguez affair, Ford ignored this. He had several aides make phone calls to 18 congressmen to inform them that military action was underway. But as I.F. Stone said, he was the maverick journalist who published the anti-establishment I.F. Stone's Weekly, "Congress raped as easily as it did in the Tonkin Gulf affair." Congressman Robert Drinan of Massachusetts was an exception. Senator McGovern, Nixon's presidential opponent in 1976 and longtime anti-war critic, opposed the action. So did Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin. Senator Edward Brooke raised questions. Senator Edward Kennedy did not speak out, nor did other senators who, during the Vietnam War, had influenced Congress to ban further military action in Indochina, but now said their own legislation did not apply. Secretary of State Kissinger would say, "We are forced into this." When Kissinger was asked why the U.S. was risking the lives of the Mayaguez seamen by firing on ships in the area without knowing where they were, he called it a necessary risk. Kissinger also said the incident ought to make clear that there are limits beyond which the United States cannot be pushed, that the United States is prepared to defend those interests, and that it can get public support and congressional support for these actions. Indeed, congressmen, Democrats as well as Republicans, who had been critical of the Vietnam War, now seemed anxious to pull things together in a unified show of strength to the rest of the world. A week before the Mayaguez affair, 2 weeks before Saigon fell, 56 congressmen had signed a statement saying, "Let no nation read the events in Indochina as the failure of the American will." One of them was a black congressman from Georgia, Andrew Young. It was a complex process of consolidation that the system undertook in 1975. It included old-type military actions like the Mayaguez affair to assert authority in the world and at home. There was also a need to satisfy a disillusioned public that the system was criticizing and correcting itself. The standard way was to conduct publicized investigations that found specific culprits but left the system intact. Watergate had made both the FBI and the CIA look bad, breaking the laws they were sworn to uphold, cooperating with Nixon in his burglary jobs and illegal wiretapping. In 1975, congressional committees in the House and Senate began investigations of the FBI and CIA. The CIA inquiry disclosed that the CIA had gone beyond its original mission of gathering intelligence and was conducting secret operations of all kinds. For instance, back in the 1950s, it had administered the drug LSD to unsuspecting Americans to test its effects. One American scientist, given such a dose by a CIA agent, leaped from a New York hotel window to his death. The CIA had also been involved in assassination plots against Castro of Cuba and other heads of state. It had introduced African swine fever virus into Cuba in 1971, bringing disease and then slaughter to 500,000 pigs. A CIA operative told a reporter he delivered the virus from an army base in the Canal Zone to anti-Castro Cubans. It was also learned from the investigation that the CIA, with the collusion of a secret committee of 40 headed by Henry Kissinger, had worked to destabilize the Chilean government headed by Salvador Allende, a Marxist who had been elected president in one of the rare free elections in Latin America. ITT, with large interests in Cuba, played a part in this operation. When in 1974, the American ambassador to Chile, David Popper, suggested to the Chilean junta, which, with U.S. aid, had overthrown Allende, that they were violating human rights, he was rebuked by Kissinger, who sent word, "Tell Popper to cut out the political science lectures." The investigation of the FBI disclosed many years of illegal actions to disrupt and destroy radical groups and left-wing groups of all kinds. The FBI had sent forged letters, engaged in burglaries, it admitted to 92 between 1960 and 1966, opened mail illegally, and, in the case of Black Panther leader Fred Hampton, seems to have conspired in murder. Valuable information came out of the investigations, but it was just enough and in just the right way. Moderate press coverage, little television coverage, thick books of reports with limited readership, to give the impression of an honest society correcting itself. The investigations themselves revealed the limits of government willingness to probe into such activities. The Church Committee, set up by the Senate, conducted its investigations with the cooperation of the agencies being investigated, and indeed submitted its findings on the CIA to the CIA to see if there was material that the agency wanted omitted. Thus, while there was much valuable material in the report, there is no way of knowing how much more there was. The final report was a compromise between committee diligence and CIA caution. The Pike Committee, set up in the House of Representatives, made no such agreement with the CIA or FBI, and when it issued its final report, the same House that had authorized its investigation voted to keep the report secret. When the report was leaked via a CBS newscaster, Daniel Shore, to the Village Voice in New York, it was never printed by the important newspapers in the country, the Times, the Washington Post, or others. Shore was suspended by CBS. It was another instance of cooperation between the mass media and the government in instances of national security. The Church Committee, in its report of CIA attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro and other foreign leaders, revealed an interesting point of view. The committee seemed to look on the killing of a head of state as an unpardonable violation of some gentleman's agreement among statesmen, much more deplorable than military interventions that killed ordinary people. The committee wrote in the introduction to its assassination report, "Once methods of coercion and violence are chosen, the probability of loss of life is always present. There is, however, a significant difference between a cold-blooded, targeted, intentional killing of an individual foreign leader and other forms of intervening in the affairs of foreign nations." The Church Committee uncovered CIA operations to secretly influence the minds of Americans. The CIA is now using several hundred American academics, administrators, faculty members, graduate students engaged in teaching, who, in addition to providing leads and, on occasion, making introductions for intelligence purposes, write books and other material to be used for propaganda purposes abroad. These academics are located in over 100 American colleges, universities, and related institutions. At the majority of institutions, no one other than the individual concerned is aware of the CIA link. At the others, at least one university official is aware of the operational use of academics on his campus. The CIA considers these operational relationships within the U.S. academic community as perhaps its most sensitive domestic area and has strict controls governing these operations. In 1961, the chief of the CIA's covert action staff wrote that books were the most important weapon of strategic propaganda. The Church Committee found that more than 1,000 books were produced, subsidized, or sponsored by the CIA before the end of 1967. When Kissinger testified before the Church Committee about the bombing of Laos, orchestrated by the CIA as a secret activity, he said, "I do not believe, in retrospect, that it was a good national policy to have the CIA conduct the war in Laos. I think we should have found some other way of doing it." There was no indication that anyone on the committee challenged this idea, that what was done should have been done, but by another method. Thus, in 1974-1975, the system was acting to purge the country of its rascals and restore it to a healthy, or at least to an acceptable, state. The resignation of Nixon, the succession of Ford, the exposure of bad deeds by the FBI and CIA, all aimed to regain the badly damaged confidence of the American people. However, even with these strenuous efforts, there were still many signs in the American public of suspicion, even hostility to the leaders of government, military, big business. 2 months after the end of the Vietnam War, only 20% of Americans polled thought the collapse of the Saigon government was a threat to United States security. June 14, 1975, was Flag Day, and President Gerald Ford spoke at Fort Benning, Georgia, where the Army staged a march symbolizing its involvement in 13 wars. Ford commented that he was glad to see so many flags, but a reporter covering the event wrote, "Actually, there were few American flags to be seen near the president's reviewing stand. One, held aloft by demonstrators, bore an inked-in inscription saying, 'No more genocide in our name.' It was torn down by spectators as their neighbors applauded." That July, the Lou Harris poll, looking at the public's confidence in the government from 1966 to 1975, reported that confidence in the military during that period had dropped from 62% to 29%, in business from 55% to 18%, in both President and Congress from 42% to 13%. Shortly after that, another Harris poll reported that 65% of Americans oppose military aid abroad because they feel it allows dictatorships to maintain control over their population. Perhaps much of the general dissatisfaction was due to the economic state of most Americans. Inflation and unemployment had been rising steadily since 1973, which was the year when, according to a Harris poll, the number of Americans feeling alienated and disaffected with the general state of the country climbed from 29% in 1966 to over 50%. After Ford succeeded Nixon, the percentage of alienated was 55%. The survey showed that people were troubled most of all by inflation. In the fall of 1975, a New York Times survey of 1,559 persons and interviews with 60 families in 12 cities showed a substantial decline in optimism about the future. The Times reported, "Inflation, the apparent inability of the country to solve its economic problems, and a foreboding that the energy crisis will mean a permanent step backward for the nation's standard of living, have made inroads into America's confidence, expectations, and aspirations. Pessimism about the future is particularly acute among those who earn less than $7,000 annually, but it is also high within families whose annual incomes range from $10,000 to $15,000. There is also concern that no longer will hard work and a conscientious effort to save money bring them a nice home in the suburbs." Even higher-income people, the survey found, are not as optimistic now as they were in past years, indicating that discontent is moving up from the lower middle income to higher economic levels. Around the same time, that fall of 1975, public opinion analysts testifying before a congressional committee reported, according to the New York Times, that public confidence in the government and in the country's economic future is probably lower than it has ever been since they began to measure such things scientifically. Government statistics suggested the reasons. The Census Bureau reported that from 1974 to 1975, the number of Americans legally poor, that is, below an income of $5,500, had risen 10% and was now 25.9 million people. Also, the unemployment rate, which had been 5.6% in 1974, had risen to 8.3% in 1975, and the number of people who exhausted their unemployment benefits increased from 2 million in 1974 to 4.3 million in 1975. Government figures, however, generally underestimated the amount of poverty, set the legally poor level too low, and underestimated the amount of unemployment. For instance, if 16.6% of the population averaged 6 months of unemployment during 1975, or 33.2% averaged 3 months of unemployment, the average annual figure given by the government was 8.3%, which sounded better. In the year 1976, with a presidential election approaching, there was worry in the establishment about the public's faith in the system. William Simon, Secretary of the Treasury under both Nixon and Ford, before then an investment banker earning over $2 million a year, spoke in the fall of 1976 to a business council meeting in Hot Springs, Virginia. He said that when so much of the world is lurching towards socialism or totalitarianism, it was urgent to make the American business system understood because private enterprise is losing by default. In many of our schools, in much of the communications media, and in a growing portion of the public consciousness. His speech could well be taken to represent the thinking of the American corporate elite. Vietnam, Watergate, student unrest, shifting moral codes, the worst recession in a generation, and a number of other jarring cultural shocks have all combined to create a new climate of questions and doubt. It all adds up to a general malaise, a society-wide crisis of institutional confidence. Too often, Simon said, Americans have been taught to distrust the very word profit and the profit motive that makes our prosperity possible, to somehow feel this system that has done more to alleviate human suffering and privation than any other is somehow cynical, selfish, and amoral. We must, Simon said, get across the human side of capitalism. As the United States prepared in 1976 to celebrate the bicentennial of the Declaration of Independence, a group of intellectuals and political leaders from Japan, the United States, and Western Europe organized into the Trilateral Commission issued a report. It was entitled The Governability of Democracies. Samuel Huntington, a political science professor at Harvard University and longtime consultant to the White House on the war in Vietnam, wrote the part of the report that dealt with the United States. He called it the democratic distemper and identified the problem he was about to discuss. The 1960s witnessed a dramatic upsurge of democratic fervor in America. In the 60s, Huntington wrote, there was a huge growth of citizen participation in the forms of marches, demonstrations, protest movements, and cause organizations. There were also markedly higher levels of self-consciousness on the part of blacks, Indians, Chicanos, white ethnic groups, students, and women, all of whom became mobilized and organized in new ways. There was a marked expansion of white-collar unionism, and all this added up to a reassertion of equality as a goal in social, economic, and political life. Huntington pointed to the signs of decreasing government authority. The great demands in the 60s for equality had transformed the federal budget. In 1960, foreign affairs spending was 53.7% of the budget, and social spending was 22.3%. By 1974, foreign affairs took 33% and social spending 31%. This seemed to reflect a change in public mood. In 1960, only 18% of the public said the government was spending too much on defense. But in 1969, this jumped to 52%. Huntington was troubled by what he saw. The essence of the democratic surge of the 1960s was a general challenge to existing systems of authority, public and private. In one form or another, this challenge manifested itself in the family, the university, business, public and private associations, politics, the governmental bureaucracy, and the military services. People no longer felt the same obligation to obey those whom they had previously considered superior to themselves in age, rank, status, expertise, character, or talents. All this, he said, produced problems for the governability of democracy in the 1970s. Critical in all this was the decline in the authority of the president, and to the extent that the United States was governed by anyone during the decades after World War II, it was governed by the president, acting with the support and cooperation of key individuals and groups in the executive office, the federal bureaucracy, Congress, and the more important businesses, banks, law firms, foundations, and media, which constitute the private sector's establishment. This was probably the frankest statement ever made by an establishment advisor. Huntington further said that the president, to win the election, needed the support of a broad coalition of people. However, The day after his election, the size of his majority is almost, if not entirely, irrelevant to his ability to govern the country. What counts then is his ability to mobilize support from the leaders of key institutions in a society and government. This coalition must include key people in Congress, the executive branch, and the private sector establishment. He gave examples. Truman made a point of bringing a substantial number of nonpartisan soldiers, Republican bankers, and Wall Street lawyers into his administration. He went to the existing sources of power in the country to get help he needed in ruling the country. Eisenhower, in part, inherited this coalition and was, in part, almost its creation. Kennedy attempted to recreate a somewhat similar structure of alliances. What worried Huntington was the loss in governmental authority. For instance, the opposition to Vietnam had brought the abolition of the draft. The question necessarily arises, however, whether if a new threat to security should materialize in the future, as it inevitably will at some point, the government will possess the authority to command the resources as well as the sacrifices which are necessary to meet that threat. Huntington saw the possible end of that quarter century when the United States was the hegemonic power in a system of world order. His conclusion was that there had developed an excess of democracy, and he suggested desirable limits to the extension of political democracy. Huntington was reporting all this to an organization that was very important to the future of the United States. The Trilateral Commission was organized in early 1973 by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski. Rockefeller was an official of the Chase Manhattan Bank and a powerful financial figure in the United States and the world. Brzezinski, a Columbia University professor, specialized in international relations and was a consultant to the State Department, as reported in the Far Eastern Economic Review, March 25, 1977, by Robert Manning. The initiative for the commission came entirely from Rockefeller. According to George Franklin, the commission's executive secretary, Rockefeller was getting worried about the deteriorating relations between the United States, Europe, and Japan. Franklin explained that Rockefeller began to present his ideas to another elite fraternity, at the Bilderberg Group, a very distinguished Anglo-American group which has been meeting for a long time. Mike Blumenthal said he thought things were in a very serious condition in the world, and couldn't some kind of private group do more about it? So then David again made his proposal. Then Brzezinski, a close friend of Rockefeller's, carried the Rockefeller-funded ball and organized the commission. It seems probable that the very serious condition mentioned as the reason for the Trilateral Commission was the need for greater unity among Japan, Western Europe, and the United States, in the face of a much more complicated threat to tricontinental capitalism than a monolithic communism, revolutionary movements in the Third World. These movements had directions of their own. The Trilateral Commission wanted also to deal with another situation. Back in 1967, George Ball, who had been Under Secretary of State for Economic Affairs in the Kennedy administration, and who was director of Lehman Brothers, a large investment banking firm, told members of the International Chamber of Commerce, "In these 20 post-war years, we have come to recognize in action, though not always in words, that the political boundaries of nation-states are too narrow and constricted to define the scope and activities of modern business." To show the growth of international economics for United States corporations, one would only have to note the situation in banking. In 1960, there were 8 United States banks with foreign branches. In 1974, there were 129. The assets of these overseas branches amounted to $3.5 billion in 1960, $155 billion in 1974. The Trilateral Commission apparently saw itself as helping to create the necessary international links for the new multinational economy. Its members came from the highest circles of politics, business, and the media in Western Europe, Japan, and the United States. They were from Chase Manhattan, Lehman Brothers, Bank of America, Banque de Paris, Lloyd's of London, Bank of Tokyo, etc. Oil, steel, auto, aeronautic, and electric industries were represented. Other members were from Time Magazine, The Washington Post, The Columbia Broadcasting System, Die Zeit, The Japan Times, The Economist of London, and more. 1976 was not only a presidential election year. It was the much-anticipated year of the bicentennial celebration, and it was filled with much-publicized events all over the country. The great effort that went into the celebration suggests that it was seen as a way of restoring American patriotism, invoking the symbols of history to unite people and government and put aside the protest mood of the recent past. But there did not seem to be great enthusiasm for it. When the 200th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party was celebrated in Boston, an enormous crowd turned out, not for the official celebration, but for the People's Bicentennial counter-celebration, where packages marked Gulf Oil and Exxon were dumped into the Boston Harbor to symbolize opposition to corporate power in America.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Chapter 21. Carter, Reagan, Bush. The Bipartisan Consensus. Halfway through the 20th century, the historian Richard Hofstadter, in his book, The American Political Tradition, examined our important national leaders from Jefferson and Jackson to Herbert Hoover and the two Roosevelts, Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives. Hofstadter concluded that the range of vision embraced by the primary contestants in the major parties has always been bounded by the horizons of property and enterprise. They have accepted the economic virtues of capitalist culture as necessary qualities of man. That culture has been intensely nationalistic. Coming to the end of the century, observing its last 25 years, we have seen exactly that limited vision Hofstadter talked about, a capitalistic encouragement of enormous fortunes alongside desperate poverty, a nationalistic acceptance of war and preparations for war. Governmental power swung from Republicans to Democrats and back again, but neither party showed itself capable of going beyond that vision. After the disastrous war in Vietnam came the scandals of Watergate. There was a deepening economic insecurity for much of the population, along with environmental deterioration and a growing culture of violence and family disarray. Clearly, such fundamental problems could not be solved without bold changes in the social and economic structure. But no major party candidates proposed such changes. The American political tradition held fast. In recognition of this, perhaps only vaguely conscious of this, voters stayed away from the polls in large numbers or voted without enthusiasm. More and more they declared, if only by non-participation, their alienation from the political system. In 1960, 63% of those eligible to vote voted in the presidential election. By 1976, this figure had dropped to 53%. In a CBS News and New York Times survey, over half of the respondents said that public officials didn't care about people like them. A typical response came from a plumber. The President of the United States isn't going to solve our problems. The problems are too big. There was a troubling incongruity in the society. Electoral politics dominated the press and television screens, and the doings of presidents, members of Congress, Supreme Court justices, and other officials were treated as if they constituted the history of the country. Yet there was something artificial in all this, something pumped up. A straining to persuade a skeptical public that this was all, that they must rest their hopes for the future in Washington politicians, none of whom were inspiring, because it seemed that behind the bombast, the rhetoric, the promises, their major concern was their own political power. The distance between politics and the people was reflected clearly in the culture. In what was supposed to be the best of the media, uncontrolled by corporate interest, that is, in public television, the public was largely invisible. On the leading political forum on public television, the nightly McNeil-Lehrer Report, the public was uninvited except as viewer of an endless parade of congressmen, senators, government bureaucrats, experts of various kinds. On commercial radio, the usual narrow band of consensus, excluding fundamental criticism, was especially apparent. In the mid-1980s, with Ronald Reagan as president, the fairness doctrine of the Federal Communications Commission, requiring airtime for dissenting views, was eliminated. By the 1990s, talk radio had perhaps 20 million listeners, treated to daily tirades from right-wing talk show hosts with left-wing guests uninvited. A citizenry disillusioned with politics and with what pretended to be intelligent discussions of politics turned its attention, or had its attention turned, to entertainment, to gossip, to 10,000 schemes for self-help. Those at its margins became violent, finding scapegoats within one's group, as with poor black on poor black violence, or against other races, immigrants, demonized foreigners, welfare mothers, minor criminals, standing in for untouchable major criminals. There were other citizens, those who tried to hold on to ideas and ideals still remembered from the 60s and early 70s, not just by recollecting, but by acting. Indeed, all across the country, there was a part of the public, unmentioned in the media, ignored by political leaders, energetically active in thousands of local groups around the country. These organized groups were campaigning for environmental protection, or women's rights, or decent health care, including anguished concern about the horrors of AIDS, or housing for the homeless, or against military spending. This activism was unlike that of the 60s, when the surge of protest against race segregation and war became an overwhelming national force. It struggled uphill against callous political leaders, trying to reach fellow Americans, most of whom saw little hope in either the politics of voting or the politics of protest. The presidency of Jimmy Carter, covering the years 1977 to 1980, seemed an attempt by one part of the establishment that represented in the Democratic Party to recapture a disillusioned citizenry. But Carter, despite a few gestures toward poor people, black people, despite talk of human rights abroad, remained within the historic political boundaries of the American system, protecting corporate wealth and power, maintaining a huge military machine that drained the national wealth, allying the United States with right-wing tyrannies abroad. Carter seemed to be the choice of that international group of powerful influence wielders, the Trilateral Commission. Two founding members of the commission, according to the Far Eastern Economic Review, David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski, thought Carter was the right person for the presidential election of 1976, given that the Watergate-plagued Republican Party was a sure loser. Carter's job as president, from the point of view of the establishment, was to halt the rushing disappointment of the American people with the government, with the economic system, with disastrous military ventures abroad. In his campaign, he tried to speak to the disillusioned and angry. His strongest appeal was to blacks, whose rebellion in the late 60s was the most frightening challenge to authority since the labor and unemployed upsurges in the 30s. His appeal was populist, that is, he appealed to various elements of American society who saw themselves beleaguered by the powerful and wealthy. Although he himself was a millionaire peanut grower, he presented himself as an ordinary American farmer. Although he had been a supporter of the Vietnam War until its end, he presented himself as a sympathizer with those who had been against the war, and he appealed to many of the young rebels of the 60s by his promise to cut the military budget. In a much publicized speech to lawyers, Carter spoke out against the use of the law to protect the rich. He appointed a black woman, Patricia Harris, as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and a black civil rights veteran, Andrew Young, as ambassador to the United Nations. He gave the job of heading the Domestic Youth Service Corps to a young former anti-war activist, Sam Brown. His most crucial appointments, however, were in keeping with the Trilateral Commission report of Harvard political scientist Samuel Huntington, which said that whatever groups voted for a president, once elected, what counts then is his ability to mobilize support for the leaders of key institutions. Brzezinski, a traditional Cold War intellectual, became Carter's national security advisor. His Secretary of Defense, Harold Brown, had, during the Vietnam War, according to the Pentagon Papers, envisaged the elimination of virtually all the constraints under which the bombing then operated. His Secretary of Energy, James Schlesinger, as Secretary of Defense under Nixon, was described by a member of the Washington Press Corps as showing an almost missionary drive in seeking to reverse a downward trend in the defense budget. Schlesinger was also a strong proponent of nuclear energy. His other cabinet appointees had strong corporate connections. A financial writer wrote, not long after Carter's election, "So far, Mr. Carter's actions, commentary, and particularly his cabinet appointments, have been highly reassuring to the business community." Veteran Washington correspondent Tom Wicker wrote, "The available evidence is that Mr. Carter, so far, is opting for Wall Street's confidence." Carter did initiate more sophisticated policies toward governments that oppress their own people. He used United States Ambassador Andrew Young to build up goodwill for the United States among the black African nations and urged that South Africa liberalize its policies towards blacks. A peaceful settlement in South Africa was necessary for strategic reasons. South Africa was used for radar tracking systems. Also, it had important U.S. corporate investments and was a critical source of needed raw materials, diamonds especially. Therefore, what the United States needed was a stable government in South Africa. The continued oppression of blacks might create civil war. The same approach was used in other countries, combining practical strategic needs with the advancement of civil rights. But because the chief motivation was practicality, not humanity, there was a tendency toward token changes, as in Chile's release of a few political prisoners. When Congressman Herman Badillo introduced in Congress a proposal that required the U.S. representatives to the World Bank and other international financial institutions to vote against loans to countries that systematically violated essential rights by the use of torture or imprisonment without trial, Carter sent a personal letter to every congressman urging the defeat of this amendment. It won a voice vote in the House, but lost in the Senate. Under Carter, the United States continued to support, all over the world, regimes that engaged in imprisonment of dissenters, torture, and mass murder. In the Philippines, in Iran, in Nicaragua, and in Indonesia, where the inhabitants of East Timor were being annihilated in a campaign bordering on genocide. The New Republic magazine, presumably on the liberal side of the establishment, commented approvingly on the Carter policies. American foreign policy in the next 4 years will essentially extend the philosophies developed in the Nixon Ford years. This is not at all a negative prospect. There should be continuity. It is part of history. Carter had presented himself as a friend of the movement against the war. But when Nixon mined Haiphong Harbor and resumed bombing of North Vietnam in the spring of 1973,